just wrapped up a news conference at Myrtle and Linden in Bushwick. Officers say they negotiated with a man who had barricaded himself inside a check and money exchange after announcing a robbery.
Ring, ring.
I want a car in 60 seconds or she dies.
Hi, my name's Ryan.
I didn't ask you what your name was. You have 55 seconds.
Don't expect resolution the first time we sit down and talk.
And the other warning for common ground is if you rely heavily on it and it's not there, what are you left with? If that's your go-to move and there is no common ground, what are you left with? You're left with either nothing or trying to lie about common ground on some level.
Just trying to get to know you a little bit. My name is Ryan.
You're not getting to know me. Then she's going to die. You understand that.
Welcome to another episode of the We Have a Meeting podcast. I'm trying to think if I've ever been more excited for a guest. I'm going to run through some accolades so you can see why. So he's a lecturer, a trainer, author of Ego Authority Failure. He has 29 years of law enforcement experience. 20 of which he served as a team member, leader, and then commander of hostage negotiation teams in Washington, D.C. He's one of the leading negotiation trainers in the world, working over at the Black Swan Group. It's Derek Gorn. Derek, thank you so much for being here.
Thank you, Zach. I appreciate the invitation.
Well, let's get into it. So we always start our podcast off the same way. So who are you and what problem do you solve?
Well, as the bio that you just read indicates, I am a trainer for the Black Swan Group. I've been with the Black Swan Group now for, this is year number 14, and it's provided me the opportunity to travel all over the globe teaching the value of improving your interpersonal communication skills, whether it's professionally or personally. We were established to provide people with the skills necessary to improve their communication 1v1, 1v many, in order to put the counterpart at ease so that they are able to share more valid, more truthful information with you. The bottom line is if you are viewed as a psychological threat within the conversation, meaningful dialogue is not going to take place. So we are a strategic business advisory firm, and we travel around the globe teaching hostage negotiations practices and principles to individuals and organizations to make their lives better, whatever that means.
And if you were to think of this as a doctor-patient analogy, what are the symptoms that a business or an individual might be experiencing that make it worthwhile getting Black Swan in or getting Derek in?
Symptoms would be people's reluctance to engage you. Symptoms would be you coming out of conversations feeling like you left something on the table. And I'm not merely talking about financially, but feeling incomplete at the conclusion of those conversations. When you're swinging and missing more than you're swinging and connecting with other people are the big ones from my perspective.
Nice. Okay. So I watched a video recently and I thought this was a really interesting take that you had. It was basically how you were highlighting that we're all buyers and we're all sellers. And you even referred to this in your, it's quite funny, in your law enforcement days, basically saying that you were selling a service and you were really good at it. And the service you were selling was jail time.
Yeah.
So what did you mean by this? Is it true? Is everything buying and selling?
Well, I didn't formulate that idea. Somebody much more intelligent than I did. His name is Daniel Pink. And I refer to his book, To Sell is Human. And in that book, he says that 1 in 9 adults in the U.S. workforce are involved in traditional sales. The other 8 out of 9 are involved in non-sales selling, where they're spending a vast majority of their day trying to get people to bite off on an idea, a proposal, a suggestion, or maybe a solution to a problem. And so they're trying to get people to comply, which is what we were doing as hostage negotiators, trying to get people to comply. And we are the best compliance people on the planet because we sold jail time and we got people to buy it the majority of the time. And the majority of the time means in excess of 93%. That is to say that 93% of the time that we get called out to an event, we're successful at saying specific things in a specific manner to elicit specific information and listening deeply to that information to understand what's motivating the behavior. The behavior that someone exhibits or the statements or questions that someone makes are all tells of something else that's going on beneath the surface. And from the Black Swan perspective, from the hostage negotiation perspective, we're always focused on the latent dynamic or emotion within a statement, within a question, within someone's behavior. The presenting dynamic or emotion is exactly the words that are coming out of their mouths or exactly the behavior that they are exhibiting. But there's a latent dynamics that's driving that statement, that's driving that question, that's driving the behavior. And when you can start to articulate for other people the latent dynamic or emotion, the things that they're not saying, this is what I always tell my coaching clients is don't focus so much on what they're saying, focus on what they're not actually saying. Because that's where the gold is found. Because if I'm able to articulate for you things that you have not said or will not say, there's no clearer demonstration that I am dialed into this conversation. And people have an innate desire to have someone else understand what their environment looks like, what their circumstances are, what they're going through. And so when we can fulfill that need, that is what removes us as a psychological threat within the conversation, and it makes people open up. And it's not because we're smarter than everybody else. It's because we have a keen appreciation of the human nature response, which dictates negative emotions, negative dynamics, drive decision-making, and drive behavior, period. And once you get your head around that, you put yourself at a distinct advantage because people start to become predictable. And who doesn't like predictability?
Yeah, great point. So it kind of sounds like what you're saying is it's not just about the question you're being asked. If we think about this in a sales setting, if someone brought questions to the table, it's about why is that question come up in the first place?
Exactly right. And to that point, a hack for anyone is before you answer a question, you need to be sure where that question is coming from, because people routinely ask terrible questions. They ask question A, they want the answer to question B, but something is preventing them from asking question B. And so the hack is for you, before you respond directly to the question, is simply to say to the other side, "It sounds like you have a reason for asking." And you will find that the reason that they're asking the question has nothing to do with the question that they asked. And so I know that going into the conversation. And so when I use that type of label, "It sounds like you have a reason for asking," there's a certain level of relief that the other side gets, because in their minds, from their perspective, they're waving a flag over here saying that there's a problem and they want you to pick up on it. And so this goes a long way into doing that.
I'm going to state the obvious point here, but you can probably talk about it much better than I can. There's a key tone to deliver that in. Sounds like there's a reason for asking that. You can get that wrong with the wrong tone.
It could be. Yeah. Well, Zach, you can get everything wrong with the wrong tone. If I say to you, "You know, Zach, I could kill you," sounds a lot different than "Zach, I could kill you." Same words, different inflection, carries a different tone. And Dr. Albert Mehrabian said a long time ago, whenever there is a disconnect between words and tone, people will always default to the tone over the actual words. And so to your point, tone is critical. And so when I say it, sounds like you got a reason for asking that. That's a plaintive label that says, I just don't get it. There's something else going on here that I don't understand. I am inferior to you, Zach. I need your help in understanding. I said all of that just with the tone of that label. Sounds like he got a reason for asking that. And the translation is, I'm confused about your question. I need more meat on the bone. I need more context. And I said all of that just with the tone of voice.
Beautiful. So I want to talk about persuasion a little bit. I'm big into Stoic philosophy. One of the beliefs there is that you can't persuade anyone of anything. You can only make them think. And when people realize you're trying to persuade me, they react and they tend to do the total opposite. So what are your opinions on persuasion? And if there's salespeople and business owners listening to this, is it possible to persuade someone?
You can be persuasive. You have to be careful about your approach to persuasiveness. I am a big proponent of, as you said, making people think and coming to their own conclusion. If they think and they come to their own conclusion, they're more likely to follow through with execution. When they're able to formulate solutions to the problems themselves, no one can make you say yes to anything. And as a result, we never try to push for a yes. I don't know how deep you've gone into our content, but we all, you know, it was asked of us many years ago, you know, how did you guys get hostage negotiators to say yes, or hostage takers to say yes? And the answer is, we never did. We never got them to say yes to anything. In fact, we were driving for no's more than we were driving for yeses. And the reason behind that is, no is always protection. Yes is always obligation. It's always a commitment. And those people who are in a sales environment that have been taught yes momentum, yesable propositions, yes, this one blows me away, yes tie downs. The amount of training companies out there that espouse yes tie downs is baffling to me. In other words, you're using a technique that's called a tie down with your counterpart, and you think they like that? You think that you are going to get a collaborative relationship out of that? Even if you ultimately convince that person to move in your direction, are they doing it willingly or are they doing it reluctantly? And if they're doing it reluctantly, how much pain are you signing yourself up for? Because revenge is a powerful motivator. And if you and I are engaged in a conversation and you are using yes tie downs with me, I feel you walking me in the direction that I haven't volunteered to go. And even if you get me to the point where you want to get me, when the opportunity presents itself in the future, I am going to make you feel the same level of pain that you made me feel during that conversation. And so I'm wary of terms like persuasion because in a certain vein or a certain light, that's almost like manipulation. And manipulation, what's the difference between manipulation and influence? It's the intent of the speaker. And trust me when I tell you that when your intent is threatening, it smells. The other person can smell it on you. And people don't like to be taken anywhere that they have not volunteered to go. So we always talk about deferring to the other side. We always talk about subordinating yourself to the other side. And I don't care about the hierarchy of the relationship. You can be talking about a team leader or team manager talking to a direct report. In that conversation, that team leader, team manager is going to have to subordinate themselves to their direct report at some point to remove themselves as a threat in the conversation. You're going to hear me revisit that concept over and over again. But it's all about deference and subordinating yourself first. Your goal and objective always comes last.
Amazing. So I want to jump into techniques a little bit.
Okay.
So a slight bit of background. In our business, you have to have read Never Split the Difference and implemented the techniques to get a promotion. So your initial promotion in 3 months, you have to have read it. And the bit that people struggle with mirroring is they find it awkward to deliver and they often feel like they hit a bit of a dead end. So they might speak to someone who says, "You looked at this 3 years ago." 3 years ago. Yeah. And they're uncomfortable with that little 2 second silence and they start feeling it in themselves and then they've kind of lost the magic of it.
Yeah.
So for those people out there who are trying to use that technique on cold calls or discovery calls, how can you really make sure that you're using mirroring in the proper way and getting the most out of it?
That's a great question. First of all, the problem is more with the silence than it is with the mirror. The mirror has its effect. We went over this 3 years ago. 3 years ago? Yeah. That was less than 5 seconds of silence. Look how uncomfortable you got with 5 seconds of silence. So, you have to get out of your own head. As uncomfortable as the silence is making you, it's making the other side equally as uncomfortable. Second thing I will say is, with the mirror and indeed with all of our skills, you punctuate the conversation with the skill. But the conversation is still a conversation. I would rather you stay conversational with minimal use of the Black Swan technique than trying to force them into the conversation, because when you sound rote or rehearsed or robotic, there's a certain disingenuousness in that. And again, people pick up on that. They feel like they're talking to somebody who's reading from a script or reading from cards or whatever the case may be. So authenticity is key. Getting out of your own head is key. The skills are awkward because of their counterintuitive nature. And so if you look at a mirror, use the mirror just to push the conversation along, just as an encourager for the other side to continue going. We use it in place of "tell me more," "please go on," or I get it. We went over this 3 years ago. 3 years ago? That's a question. That's that because of my upward inflection. Downward inflection, if I want to indicate that I understand where you're coming from, I would just downward inflect. 3 years ago. You get the one word response of "yeah," and then the person shuts up. What is that telling you? In the execution of all of the skills, in the execution of every conversation, you have to go into those conversations assuming you don't have the complete picture, assuming that you have something to learn, staying curious. And so immediately, when I get a one-word response to a mirror, and that's it, 9 times out of 10, the person on the other side they understand that I'm looking for more information and they're refusing to give it. So instead of getting all wrapped up in my own emotions as to why is he acting like this, why is he not sharing the information with me, I'm going to try to figure out what's causing him to be so guarded. When people hit you with one word responses, they don't trust you with any more information. There's a lack of trust within the conversation, because if he wanted to talk, he would talk. So go back to what I was talking about earlier. For whatever reason, The person hitting me with one word responses is saying to me, Derek, I do not trust you in this conversation. From my perspective, I now have to find out why. Because the conversation is not going anywhere until I address the lack of trust in that moment. I can ignore it if I want to. I can stay wrapped up in my own feelings going, why is he being a jerk? As opposed to saying to myself, what would cause him to not trust me with further information?
So that's back to your point before around it's not what's being said. It's the space between. It's what's not being said.
Exactly right.
Yeah.
One word response is yeah. That's the actual word that came out of this person's mouth. The message associated with that is voluminous.
Yeah.
There's something about his engagement with me that is making him uncomfortable, but that's where I need to focus. If I ignore it, it ain't going anywhere. If I try to pretend it's not there or otherwise try to explain it away, it's not going to bear any fruit.
Beautiful.
And the conversation is not going to move forward until you stay in that moment and figure out what the issue is.
And when you're using this technique, are you looking for kind of like vague language, things that are open to interpretation? Is there something you're always looking for where that part of your brain goes off and thinks?
I'm looking at what it does the behavior line up with the realities of the conversation and the environment? If it does not, it's always coming from an emotional place. I'll say that again. When behavior or words do not line up with the realities of the environment, it's being deliberate through an emotional prism, and you're not going anywhere until you figure that out. So what I'm looking for is what motivated that response? What motivated that behavior? Because even the person that gives you the one word response, they're trying to tell you something else, and they're not using the right communication method to do that. And so when I can start to pull that apart based on what they didn't say, I'm releasing chemicals in the brain for them. They're starting to feel better about me, and they don't know why. That oxytocin and dopamine is starting to have an effect on them. And they're starting to find a certain level of like or pleasure in dealing with me. They'll never admit it, and they'll never acknowledge it until post conversation, probably. And we may or may not come to an agreement, but they're going to walk away from there going, that guy shut his mouth and listened. He picked up on things that I was even unaware of. It was cool talking to him. And I've increased, even if there's not an agreement, I've increased my chances that if I reach out to that person again, they're going to pick up the phone. They're going to return my email. And so I'm always looking for motivation. Staying curious in the conversation, staying curious in the moment. I can't remember who actually said it, but the quote goes, interested people become interesting people. And you will find that if you start to communicate with people on a deeper level, they feel almost an obligation to return the favor to you. This is why we sequence our conversations the way we do. It's always tactical empathy first, and our goal and objective comes last. And once I get to my goal and objective, it's going to be a certain level of explaining that I have to do to the other side. And when I'm explaining to them, I want them as in the most cognitively nimble state that they can be in. And that starts with heavy doses of tactical empathy on the front end.
So we can do the same about labeling. I think that's a good place to go next. So with labeling, what I often hear as a sort of a bit of a mistake is very surface level use of it. So
yep.
If someone says, that's frustrating in conversation, you at the end of it say, that sounds frustrating, doesn't really go anywhere. Very, very surface level. So
correct.
Can you tell us about labeling, how it works in general, but how we should be using it to get the most out of it?
Okay, so first of all, label is a verbal observation of information you're getting, data you're getting from the other side, data you're gathering with your ears, data that you're gathering with your eyes. Your eyes are what's going to tell you what's going on beneath the surface. Labeling the presenting dynamic, the actual words that come out of a person's mouth, to your point, it's almost worthless. If you say, hey, I just had a frustrating conversation, and I say, you sound like you're frustrated. I mean, no kidding. That's what you just said. And that shows me, or it should show you, that I'm listening basically we call it intermittent listening, where I'm listening long enough to get the gist of what you're saying, and then I focus my thought process is on my own internal monologue. And that's not going to get you anywhere. That is not what we call empathetic listening. Empathetic listening is you taking my emotion, my logic, my worldview, understanding my motivations, understanding what the lay of the land looks like from my perspective. Because at the end of the day, if you don't understand my worldview, you don't understand me. And if you do not understand me, meaningful dialogue is not going to take place. So how did you say it? I just came out of a frustrating meeting. That's kind of vanilla, kind of bland. So if you come out of that meeting and you say, oh my gosh, I just came out of a frustrating meeting, my label to that is going to be, sounds like that meeting was a complete waste of your time. And whomever you met with just kicked you in the stomach the entire 30, 40 minutes that you were in there. Now, you never said any of those things. That's just what I'm picking up intuitively. And so I'm going to throw it out there. Now, I may hit the nail right on the head. I may be way off base. No, he didn't kick me in the stomach the entire time. He just showed up to the meeting unprepared, and we wound up talking about things that we've already discussed, which is what made it a complete waste of time. Okay, I missed the mark, but I've gone from speculation to knowing. And you're never worse off when you go from speculating about something to now knowing whether or not it is the fact. And so gathering data with your eyes, understanding tone of voice will tell you a lot about the actual words that came out of their mouths. And what I've done for you with that type of label is I've expressed interest. I made the attempt. This is the one aspect in your life where you get credit for the attempt, not the outcome. Just making the attempt to understand what that statement meant is going to bear you a lot of fruit that you're going to be able to use to your advantage later in the conversation.
When we've had Brandon and Sandy on before, they were very forthcoming with, this is the technique that we're the strongest at. Do you know who said they were strongest at what?
I would say probably, I don't know. I would say Sandy probably said labeling and calibrated questions. Brandon, got no idea.
So Brandon was telling us about the hotel room upgrade. So he was telling us all about the accusation audit, but then he was saying that mirroring was a sweet spot. And then Sandy was talking about summary as a bit of a sweet spot. So I suppose same question for you. It's only fair to ask you, which of the techniques do you feel I'm a black belt in that one every time?
Accusations audits, without question.
Okay.
Accusations audits, without question. The accusations audit is just a preemptive label. You're making a situationally insightful, intelligent guess about what's going on with the other party. And you are demonstrating for them with the accusations audit that this conversation isn't all about me. The three places within the conversation where I use the accusations audits are at the beginning, before bad news, and before making an ask. It's just, it's a selfless act. If you and I were going to get together and talk about possibly partnering together on some endeavor, there are certain negative things that you are going to be thinking about me and this potential partnership. You're going to be worried about whether or not I'm a straight shooter or whether or not I'm going to take advantage of you based on your previous experience. And so I'm going to lead off with that in my, with my accusations audit, because I want that to be my first salvo, if you will, for as far as tactical empathy is concerned. And so at the beginning of the conversation, you know, if I'm going to prep for this conversation with you, I'm going to sit down and take some time to think about, all right, if I was Zach, what would I be thinking about this conversation coming up? What would I be thinking about me? What would I be thinking about what we're going to discuss? And then I would say to myself, out of those, what are the negatives? And those are the statements that I would lead with. Likewise, if we're getting to the back end of the conversation, we're going to now start talking about price or commission or rate of pay or other terms. I know that's going to be dicey. And so I'm going to set that up with one or two accusations on it. If I'm going to make an ask of you, if I'm going to tell you no, I'm going to set it up with accusations on it. It allows the counterpart to brace themselves for news that they're not going to want to hear. And it's a courtesy. And people will, I love it so much because people go to the far end of the fear spectrum when you start with your accusations on it. If I were to say to you, Zach, I got news for you, and you're not going to want to hear it. You're going to want to reach through this camera screen and stab me in the eye with a pen. Immediately, you think to yourself, oh my goodness, what could this guy say to me that would make me want to stab him in the eye with a pen? And your brain starts to conjure up all of these horrific things. You have no idea where I'm going. And then I make my ask. And whatever the ask is, it pales in comparison to what you imagined. And you're relieved. And you're more likely to give me what I need. Case in point, Brandon talked about the hotel upgrades. I don't go after hotel upgrades as much as he does. But I do go after getting early check-ins, if you will. You know, when I fly to a destination city, I usually get in, you know, 2-3 hours before, quote, allowable check-in, which means one of two things. They want me to pay a fee to check in early, or they want me to check my bags and I got to walk around the city for 2 hours until the room is ready. I'm not inclined to do either one of those things. And so when I walk in to the hotel lobby, I make a situationally insightful, intelligent guess about what's going on with that person behind the counter. They're probably not thrilled with their job. They're probably putting out customer fires all of the time. No one appreciates what they do. They're used to getting dumped on over and over again. And so I will approach the counter, and the first words out of my mouth are, I'm about to make your day that much more difficult. And I can just see their shoulders roll forward. And now they're not even looking at me. They're just looking down at their counter. They're saying to themselves, bring it on, bring it on, bring it on. And then I follow with, you're probably going to think I'm another needy traveler who expects you to bend over backwards for everything that I need. Now they're going crazy. They're like, come on, bring it on. They don't know. They don't know if I've committed a goat sacrifice in the parking lot or drove my car into the pool or I've got 20 pounds of cocaine in my luggage. They have no idea what I'm going to hit them with. But again, they've gone to the far end of the fear spectrum and their brains are just going crazy. And then I hit them with, how bad of a position would I put you in if I checked in early? They are so relieved that that's all I wanted. They start banging on that keyboard and they're like, we got a room for you. Oh, look, it's an executive suite. You're now on the 17th floor as opposed to the third floor. And it's a courtesy for me because it's a return of favor, so to speak. These skills, particularly the accusations audit, encourages reciprocity because I took the time to give them, to brace themselves, I should say, they want to return the favor because they are relieved that it wasn't what they thought. They want to return the favor. And it's usually by way of allowing me to check in early, oftentimes with an upgrade. But yeah, to answer your original question, it is the accusations audit. It is my go-to. It is my favorite. And that's the one that I wield like a broadsword.
Nice. I'm going to steal that technique from you in that scenario. And
please,
when we speak, I'll be telling you if it's worked or not. So not time for too much more. I wanted to talk about ego authority failure. So what inspired the book? What gap did you see where you thought, okay, there's a space here? What were the symptoms and the problems that you were trying to solve?
You know, society have been talking about the importance of emotional intelligence in the workplace, the importance of emotional intelligence in leadership for well over 30 years now. And there have been numerous books written about it. There have been numerous articles, blog posts, podcasts that speak to that. And none of those go beyond the generic, you know, create a positive work environment, be inclusive. Don't be a jerk to your direct reports. All of those things are touted as being very important for the product or for the organization to progress. None of the books told you how to do it. And that was the dearth. They had all these concepts about great ideas, but none of them talked about actually how you do it. And so that was one of the motivations behind the book. And just the abhorrent leadership that I either was exposed to or witnessed in my time in law enforcement. And as I started to talk to people in the private sector, I found that it wasn't relegated to just law enforcement. There are organizations that are being run into the ground by people who take this posture that it's all about the organization or it's all about them. And they tend to start to alienate the direct reports, the worker bees, to the point where they're leaving. And there was a survey that I talked about in the book. Condescension, mean temper, bad behavior. Those were the top three reasons that people were leaving bosses. Not leaving organizations, leaving bosses. They were leaving the bosses because of those top three things. And I thought to myself, well, we're in the mid-2000s now. Why is this still an issue? So it bothered me for a while, and so I decided, let me share what I learned and marry it up with the Black Swan technique to provide a how-to, if you will, for management and leadership professionals. Now, the book is out. If they continue to conduct themselves after reading the book in the same fashion they did before they read the book, then that's on them. I can't do anything about that, but I felt that I was kind of obligated to not just complain about it, but to provide a tool. And now if they choose not to do it, it's a deliberate act on their part. It's not because they didn't know. So that's where I was coming from when I authored the book.
Do you think, in your experience, bad leaders are led by an inferiority complex or a superiority complex?
more often than not, it's inferiority. People, there's a vast majority of the population that needs to justify who they are within the hierarchy of the organization, especially those people that are blue flamers. The blue flamers are the ones that rise rapidly within any organization. And they spend all of their time at one level within the organization, preparing to get themselves to the next level. And when they start to rise that rapidly, they don't have the same level of institutional knowledge that more seasoned people do. They recognize it. The more senior people recognize it. And so these men and women are on a quest to justify their elevation within the organization. And that usually leads to a lot of micromanagement. That usually leads to what I mentioned before, condescension. That usually leads to them second guessing a lot of the work that their worker, that the direct reports do. So I think it's largely inferiority complex, because they need to show that they are the shiniest object in the drawer. The flip side of that, the people who are quote doing it right are the ones that train their people up and then get out of their way. Show them what they need to do. Tell them what the expectations are, and then sit back and watch. Be available as a resource as necessary, but get out of the weeds. Because if I start to second guess you, Zach, if I start to micromanage what you're doing, the message I'm sending you is I don't trust you to do it right. And so you become an employee who either leaves, or worse, you leave, but you don't leave. And you're just, we used to call it road back in the law enforcement days. Road is retired on active duty. So these are the people that just check out. And it's, in my opinion, the people who just leave, but don't leave, are worse than the people that actually leave. But at the end of the day, the leadership is what created that environment. So they have to deal with it.
Couldn't agree more. So look, I've only got through half the things I wanted to talk about. It's been great to have you on, even better than I thought it would be. So thank you for taking the time. I've got just a couple of rapid fire questions, if I can.
Yeah.
What's your favorite question to ask in a negotiation setting?
I don't have questions to ask in a negotiation setting. I get away from asking questions because I know a full third of the population has problems with direct questions. And so any question that I want to ask, I turn it into an asking label. So instead of saying, you know, why'd you wear that color shirt today? My asking label would be like, seems like there's a reason why you chose that shirt today. We're moving completely away from asking questions to pull out information from the other side. We're using asking labels instead. What we're using questions for now is to shape thinking. So when I want to shape your thought process, I'm going to ask you specific questions, and usually what and how questions, on helping me to solve a problem. You and I agree that you're going to talk to me on Friday to give me an answer to my questions and to tell me whether or not we're going to move forward with this partnership. And so I'm going to say to you, sounds like Friday's going to be a better day for you. Yes. Okay, Zach, when you leave here today, you're going to talk to people back in your organization that are going to say to you, dealing with Derek is not a good idea. What concretely are you going to say to them to allay their concerns? What do you need from me to help that conversation go better? If I haven't heard from you by 12 p.m. on Friday, what should my next move be? And so I'm shaping your thinking. I'm having you come up with solutions to my problem. And it means you're more likely to follow through with that because you came up with it. I didn't say to you, there are going to be people that are going to whisper in your ear that dealing with me is not a good idea. Here's what I want you to tell them. I didn't say that. I said, what are you going to tell them? And then what do you need from me? So subconsciously, the ball's in your court. You've agreed to do X, Y, and Z, which means because it didn't come from me, it came from you, you're more likely to follow through. So I get away from asking questions at all. And I use asking labels to drive out the information that I need.
I know I said this was rapid fire, but if I don't ask you about something, I'll kick myself. When you said then about, so you're going to go back to your office and people are going to say, don't work with Derek, what are you going to tell them concretely? Does it have to be that that leading, or could it be, what will you tell them? Is there a reason why there's the extra layer to it?
No, there's no reason. I get verbose, so I tend to talk a lot, and so that's where that's coming from. But what will you tell them works just as well. More important in that sequence is, what do you need from me to make that conversation go better? Because I'm it's just a subliminal message I'm sending you that, Zach, you're not on an island in this. I want you to be my cheerleader, but I'm going to help you in any way I can to be that cheerleader, my champion within your organization.
Beautiful, beautiful. Favorite book other than your own and Never Split a Difference?
I only get one?
I'll give you more than one. I'll
give you my favorite. My favorite is Ride of a Lifetime, Bob Iger, chairman of Disney. The book is replete with tactical empathy, and he doesn't know anything about our stuff, when he wrote it. But here's a man who got it. Here is a man who is in charge of a $1 billion company that's global, that understands the importance of viewing the world through the eyes of the people that he engages. And it's a great read because I'm just a nerd for that stuff, especially when people haven't been trained. They just intuitively have it in them. The other one I wanted to mention is called Black Banners. It's written by Ali Sufan about interrogation of enemy combatants. And basically, it's a tome about getting more with honey than you do with vinegar, which is a tactical empathy perspective as well.
Beautiful.
Anybody anywhere on the planet would tell you anything that you wanted to know if they trusted you. And it's all about building that level of trust. That's what that book is about.
Black Banner.
Yeah, Black Banners, yes.
Banners, got it, okay. And then the last one, favorite quote or mantra that gets you through a tough negotiation or day?
It's not about you, as in me. It's not about me. In every conversation, I have to go in with that mindset. It's not about me. You have a different worldview than I do. The two of us have different worldviews than my wife. In fact, I would submit to you that you need to go into your conversations assuming that the person that you're engaged with does not view things the way you view things. In fact, there's a 66% chance that the person you're dealing with has a vision about the conversation, about the potential outcome, that is different from yours. And so if you go into the conversation with this idea that it's not about you, it's about the other side, that makes subordinating yourself and deferring, as I mentioned earlier, a lot easier.
Amazing. Derek, thank you so much for joining us today.